Explain gardening for the Gulf Coast with Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Well, I don't know how we got here, but we're here. We're fully here this morning. Welcome back to the Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. We're in new places doing new things. So today, we're a little bit of an experiment. So if anything goes wrong, we're going to try to fix it. Listen, this is it. You're going to need a really good excuse, this morning not to, and this week, not to plant your tomatoes, not to plant your peppers. It's coming up on time. Everything about the weather is correct. Let's think about that today. Let's get that right today. Will you give me a call? There's no excuse for waiting on the tomatoes if you're on the Gulf Coast. If you're in central Alabama, you could wait a week or two. But, you know, here's the honest to goodness truth. Nothing's going to change much over the next 2 weeks. And what you need to do is be prepared for that. Be prepared for the fact that conditions are good. You don't know what's going to happen that last week in March. You don't know if something strange is going to happen. You gotta plan for that. We'll talk about that, how that works this morning. So you stay tuned. It's going to be a great week for planting. Just everything in the weather says it's going to stay warm for a good long while. Go ahead and get it done. Get it done as quickly as you can. Let's talk this morning about something that's really important for this time of year. And I promised we were going to be talking more about this this spring. What's happening right now? I saw it last week. It's not going to happen so much this week because it's raining too much. But last week we saw it. Lots of smoke coming from different places. Lots of people out burning. I spent a Sunday a couple of weeks ago doing a little bit of burning. Might spend some Sundays going forward doing a little bit of burning if the weather is right. It's fire. And somebody asked me the other day, because I keep saying, you can't understand Alabama. You can't understand wildflowers. You can't understand when I talk about diversity in Alabama. You can't understand why Alabama is diverse if you don't talk about fire. And so if you're talking about having wildflowers in your front yard and you want Alabama wildflowers in your front yard, even if you don't use fire, you have to understand a little bit about fire and how it contributed to those wildflowers, because it does. It contributes to most of what happens here. So we're going to talk about fire today. We're going to talk about what it does. And we're going to talk about how you may have to imitate it just a little bit as you're working on your yard. And if you want, or your pasture, or your fields, if you really want to return to what is natural for Alabama, So if I had somebody said, so tell a person, what are you going to tell a person if you've got a group of third graders? Not to say you're a bunch of third graders. We're all a bunch of third graders when it comes to fire. But so all of us third graders who are new to fire, what do we say? What's the word that we give that's really simple to understand? And the first thing I would say is the reason we burn is because fire in Alabama is as natural as rain. It is as natural as rain. It's as inevitable as rain. It may, you could delay fire, but it's going to eventually happen. If you don't have fire in most ecosystems, in most places, in most forests, in most fields, in Alabama, If you delay it too long, you lose that system altogether. You lose that forest. It becomes a forest of junk. And many of our forests are, frankly, forests of junk, of trees that were never there before, that don't actually have much value to wildlife or to anything else. They just create a lot of shade, create damage on the ground. What are some of those trees? Oh, gosh, you don't want me to say it out loud. Live oaks. Probably one of the greatest impacts that we've had in South Alabama is that live oaks have spread now to many forests where they didn't occur before. And the result is that those forests are much lower quality for wildlife. Live oaks where they were native, live oaks where they were natural, that's a different thing. They had a real role to play there. And there were many other things that kept them, that kept those areas rich and natural. But it's interesting what happens when we get these junk forests where all these things are occurring that didn't used to occur. So what does fire do? It's as natural as rain. In the old days, before we did fire suppression, the woods around Mobile were probably burning, three or four times every decade. And that's something you need to think about. You have to how does that happen? How does that work? Without people, there was lightning. Lightning created the kind of ignition sources that, particularly during March, April, May, and June, that tended to bring fire to landscapes as long as there was enough fuel to burn in those landscapes. These are things you have to think about. And what did the fire do? What's the most important thing that fire would do in the landscape and in your yard? The most important thing you could do is that it brings sunlight. It brings sunlight in some really interesting ways, because when we get these junk forests, one of the problems with those forests, like the live oak forest, is there's no sunlight on the ground anymore. And what does that do? It means that the only thing there is the live oak and the leaves underneath the live oak and maybe a few vines that can survive under those conditions. So what does that do for wildlife? What does that do for quail? What does that do for turkey? What does that do for all of the creatures who were once dependent on seeds, on insects, on all of these things that were on the ground layer that aren't there anymore? And what does that do for wildflowers that need sunlight to grow? How does that affect them? These are things we have to think about when we're thinking about fire, and that's what we want to talk about today. So how are you going to use all this in your yard? How are you going to use this in your yard? One, it's understanding that you've got to figure out a way to, if you've got wildflowers, you've got to figure out, how do I let the wildflowers grow without having them overtaken by shrubs and trees and briars and things that get much taller than the wildflowers and shade them out? How am I going to do that? That's what fire did. That's what fire does, as importantly as anything else. There's also some things that you have to remember. Some native plants don't bloom at all unless there's fire that same year. And then they'll bloom. There's a lot of reasons for that. You probably can't reproduce that, but it just means you need to know that some of those plants may not bloom without fire in the same year. That's a really another important thing. And there's a third thing that fire does, besides bringing light and besides triggering flowering. And this is really important. It changes the soil where it is. And that's important, because most of our fire-maintained forest didn't have conventional topsoil. They had topsoil that was made out of charcoal. Really interesting, isn't it? We'll be back. We're going to be talking about planting tomatoes. We're going to be talking about fire. Give us a call, 251-343-0106.
You can take all tea and chai.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Yeah, we're talking about tomatoes. It's time to get them out. If you're on the Gulf Coast, you call me. I mean, don't start the seeds now. You've missed the boat. If you start the seeds, you're not going to be able to, just wait a while. We'll talk about that. If you've missed the boat, you don't have the seeds, you still want to plant tomatoes, let's talk about that. Let's talk about when to do it. But you need an 18-inch transplant. Tomato about, somewhere between 12 and 18 inches tall, ready to go out into the garden. We'll talk about how to plant that if you're ready to plant. You have any questions about it, we'll talk about how deep you need to plant it. Your soil is what you got right now. We can talk about that. We'll try to figure out the best way we can how to use the soil that you've got. But I hope you built that soil up with organic matter. That's a really important thing for a garden. And time to get those tomatoes in. And we're also going to talk about fire this morning, because it's the season of fire. We're coming up on the season of fire. We're going to see more people burning. You're going to wonder why they're doing that. And you're going to wonder, gosh, should I do it? What are the benefits? And yeah, we're going to talk about biochar. We're going to talk about terra preta. We're going to talk about the benefits of how that fire can change the soil and what we're learning about how fire changes soil and the difference that it makes and how things grow, particularly in sandy soil regions, but everywhere that fire occurs. So we're going to try to talk about a little bit of all of those things. So give us a call this morning, 251-343-0106, 251-343-0106. A caller says we were fortunate to go to Yellowstone, a texter. We were fortunate to go to Yellowstone after a big fire and to see the wildflowers, and they were spectacular. And that's, you know, throughout the United States, most ecosystems in the United States were managed with fire naturally. Who did the management? The weather, nature. So it was usually a lightning strike. It didn't take a lot of lightning strikes, because with one strike of lightning, if you didn't have a bunch of fire crews, if you didn't have a bunch of fields, if you didn't have a bunch of roads, that fire would travel really far. And because it was so easy for fire to occur, the fires were not that intense. Think about that. When fire occurs frequently, it burns up the fuel. So you don't get these big, massive fires that we're getting now, where you get decades of fuel building up that the fire can burn into. All those things are important. Fire doesn't eliminate forests either. It curries forest, if you will. It manages forest, and it tends to, because forest grew up with fire in most cases, it tends to encourage certain species and discourage others. So if you're looking at, for example, the regeneration of really high quality oaks, white oaks used to be very important in our forest, for example. And they were pretty abundant throughout Alabama. And now they're becoming very hard to find, and everybody's in a panic, and everybody realizes, gosh, what happened? Well, white oaks are pretty fire resistant. And it looks like regeneration of white oaks, getting a new generation of white oaks, usually requires some intervention of fire. We can try to imitate that, and that's what we're doing. But understanding that fire was really important to white oaks and to a lot of our higher quality oaks, including some of even many of our red oaks. Understanding that is really important to understanding forest. Most of our rare plants and trees require some sort of fire, and we can't really save those plants and trees unless we have fire there. And then we have these incredible habitats that were mostly grasslands, and they were managed by fires. That includes savannas, like our longleaf pine savannas and our shortleaf pine savannas, where it was like, people say, a prairie with trees. That's what a savanna is. And the fire would manage those. You would get incredible wildflowers. The greatest concentration of wildflowers, likely in North America, occurs in longleaf pine ecosystems. Maybe one of the densest in the world. There are very few places like Splinter Hill Bog in Baldwin County, which is maintained by fire. I hope we don't lose it to the development that's occurring around it. But it was mostly maintained by fire. And if you can imagine 40, 50, and sometimes 60 species of plants per square meter, that's square yard. We're not talking about just the number of plants there. We're talking about the number of species in each square yard, about the size of a beach towel. Extraordinary diversity that occurs there. Really interesting how all that works. It's all about fire, maintaining that diversity, maintaining access to sunlight, and maintaining those ecosystems. Prairies in central Alabama. Alabama was famous for its prairies. The Black Belt prairies of central Alabama influenced American politics in ways you probably don't even think about. It was hugely important. And it all comes back to those prairies and how people exploited those prairies and how those prairies were created because of fire over the long haul. We've lost nearly all of those prairies because of plowing, but mostly now because of fire suppression. And how we manage those prairies now with lawnmowers rather than with fire. So we'll talk about all those things. Fire becomes incredibly important. You're going to see a whole lot more of it. Yes, it's natural. No, it doesn't do harm. How are you going to learn about this in your own yard? Remember sunlight. And remember that you've got to, if you want wildflowers, you've got to figure out, how do I get these wildflowers sunlight without allowing them to be overtopped by shrubs and trees? Important thing, I think mostly in most yards, you can almost do it, almost, if you mow once or twice a year. That still creates a few problems. We've got some issues there. Bermuda grass and other things are going to want to take over. But mowing once or twice a year may be able to imitate fire pretty well. So when do you mow? Best time to mow is not in fall, but in early spring or in middle spring, because that imitates what fire did, right? So that's the most important time. Most important time to do it. We're going to talk about biochar. We're going to talk about other things that happen when fire burns through and creates new types of soil. And that's what fire does. It's not the most important thing, but it is a very important thing that fire does. It creates new types of soil. We're going to talk about that this morning. All right. So Can I address ants? They're driving me crazy. And planters, vegetables, flower beds. I've read about and tried a few natural solutions, but not sure if they're really going to work. Try to avoid pesticides. Any advice would be appreciated. We bring plagues on ourselves. We continue to bring plagues on ourselves. It's really important to remember that Mobile is one of the great entry points for most, for many of the plagues that affect Eastern North America. One of the worst ports of entry for diseases and damaging insects in the United States. Charleston and Savannah give us a good run at times, but Mobile has been the port of entry for a long time. Probably the fire ants would have come in somewhere else if they had not come in through Mobile, but they came in through Mobile in the 40s, 30s, and 20s, 30s, and 40s. We've tried for a long time to stop them, and they're very hard. You know, I planted some nasturtiums the other day, I'll tell you, and I planted them in containers and put them inside on the coldest nights. The soil in those containers had fire ants in them. The fire ants survived inside the house, just in those containers. I'm going to tell you how in just a minute. And then we're going to talk a little bit more about fire ants.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Okay, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. We're thinking about lots of things. Thinking about fire. We're thinking about fire ants. Which is different than fire. Very much different than fire. I want to say, and I guess I should preface this by saying that something worse than fire ants is on its way. And I hope it doesn't get here anytime soon, but I fear it will within a matter of a few years. It's probably already in Alabama. In fact, it is in Alabama in several places. These are Asian needle ants. They're going to have a much bigger impact on your yard, I suspect, even than fire ants. And we keep introducing these things. And I wanted to come back to that because each time we find a way to, you know, sort of deal with one pest, we've got another pest coming in. And it's a big problem. And we really need to quit being, is it worthwhile me saying we really need to be careful about this? And being careful about this is not just about what you can do. It's about making sure that when we have ports of entry and when we bring planes in and when we bring ships in, that we are very careful. And when folks bring stuff back in their luggage, we're very careful to inspect that. And that inspection is the most important thing you can do to protect your yard from things like diseases like the citrus greening disease, which is going to just, once if it becomes established in Alabama, it's going to make growing the citrus that we love virtually impossible. And it's very close to becoming established. There's lots of other diseases like that that have already had huge consequences. Diseases that are affecting everything from sassafras to red bay. Diseases that are going to affect every ash tree in North America. And Alabama is famous for its ash, actually. So was the Louisville slugger. We're about to lose them. We lost the chestnut this way, which was a huge component of our forest. We've got so many black walnut diseases coming in, beech diseases coming in, because we're not careful. We're not careful about what we bring in. So I've got to say, every time somebody says, what do I do about fire ants? I say, what are we doing about introducing worse things? And there are worse things. There are worse things, believe me. What are you going to do about fire ants? So a couple of thoughts. We talk about this a lot. Somebody said that they used to take fire ants and dump one mound on another to watch them fight it out, and it was a lot of fun, but they recognized that all they did was move, and that's about right. And what you've got to recognize is that a lot of the so-called cures for fire ants are basically, even most of the pesticides, honestly, are just about making the fire ants move from one place to another. It's very hard to eradicate fire ants. In fact, let's just say it's impossible unless you're let's say every homeowner in Mobile and every store would have to adopt a very similar technique over a huge area, and they would suppress fire ants for 2 or 3 or 4 years, and then they'd be back because we're moving around, because they move, and they quickly, rapidly recolonize from outside that area. So eradication is just not possible. It's just not possible. And you can feel free to try. Tell me how it works. You eradicate them permanently from your yard with 1 or 2 treatments, and I'll give you a couple of treatments, 3 treatments. But really what you would have to do is next to impossible. So you have to learn to live with them, and you have to learn to do the best things. Most of the treatments are about making those fire ants move. Let me tell you why putting one fire ant colony on another doesn't really stop the fire ants anymore. And in fact, they may not even fight anymore, because now we've helped to promote multi-mound colonies where the colonies may have more than one queen. And they're scattered over multiple mounds, but they basically cooperate. And they don't fight it out. There you go. It's really an interesting, it's sort of an interesting phenomenon. And most of the colonies in Mobile and Baldwin County and in many parts of the state are now these multiple queen colonies that cooperate. Wow. What a thing. And yet, here I am. I planted my nasturtiums. I brought the pots inside. The pots had a few fire ants in there. I didn't know how many, but too many. And probably I ended up with something like a queen in one of those pots. What were they going to feed on? What were they going to eat? My nasturtium seeds, which they did quite well and quite thoroughly. I probably got a very few nasturtium seeds left. Those of us who've had some problems with nasturtium seeds germinating in the past may want to look at fire ants, but that's clearly what was happening. What did I do? Well, I soaked the pots really well. I took the pots outside. I put them in water up to their necks. The fire ants, while they can float on water really well, they can't survive in containers that are saturated with water. I saturated the plants for a while, right up to the rims. The fire ants floated to the surface. I picked off some of them, but it was annoying enough that they moved out and left, and I replanted nasturtiums. The nasturtiums that did manage to germinate turned out to be fine after all of that soaking, and now I think I'll do okay. The basic thing is you gotta use mechanical means to basically get the fire ants to move. And one of the best mechanical means I know of is water. And if you water an area and you water it pretty persistently, those fire ants are going to move. You can also use a shovel and just stir the pile up, do it for 3 or 4 days, do it every other day for a week. And almost inevitably, those fire ants are going to move because they realize, fire ants have a tendency to want to be alone. They want to be left alone. They don't want to be bothered. And that's why they sting you, because they think you're going to quit bothering them. But if you keep bothering for several days, don't stick your hand in the mound. Don't stick your foot in the mound. Just use a shovel. Bother them for several days. They're going to move. You can do that with water. You can do that with a shovel. It works very effectively. So there's the old story about using grits to get rid of fire ants, put it on the mound. They eat the grits, and the grits swell up in their bodies, and the ants explode. It still tickles me when I have to say it out loud. That's the story. It's not true. Please believe me, it is not true. It is not true at all. It's just not only that there's no scientific evidence for it, it's just patently absurd on its surface. That's not what happens. If ants move because you put fire ants on the mound, it's probably because you disturbed the mound, and nobody likes having grits poured on top of their house. So there it is. They just moved. You didn't kill them. The same is true with putting, putting club soda on there, that somehow that created carbon dioxide that depleted all the oxygen and all the ants in the colony died. And the evidence of that was that the fire ants weren't there in the colony anymore. Well, the fire ants weren't in the colony because you poured club soda on their house and they decided to move, not because you killed them. So there it is. You can use Dom Perignon. That's probably as effective as club soda. So you can use Dom Perignon as an alternative to club soda, or you can use water, which is just as effective as Dom Perignon or club soda. Disturb the mound, get them to move. That's the best we can hope for right now. I could talk long-term about what could happen to reduce the pressure of fire ants. Probably the most likely thing is that we get another ant that's as successful or more successful. And that may be what we have with Asian needle ants. We'll see. And the Asian needle ants, oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. I don't want to have to deal with them. We have some new treatments coming out that may be able to target these pests more specifically. They probably won't be super cheap. And they're probably 4, 5, 6 years into the future. But people are working on some interesting things to see how they work. Let's quit talking about fire ants. Let's talk a little bit more about tomatoes. And how we're going to and getting those out. What other things that need to be planted? I think it's too early for eggplants. I'll be honest. I don't see any big reason to go with eggplants right now. Rusty's talking about Rusty is putting his peppers and eggplants in containers, and I think that's fine. If you've got good peppers, not bell peppers so much, but peppers like some of the South American peppers, habaneros, those kinds of things, they'll tolerate the heat. And so you can put them out a little bit later. Putting them into containers right now, the timing is just about right, Rusty. I think you're doing just about right. Rusty's over in Moss Point. I think you got your timing just about right. Let those get a little bit bigger. And if you're going to keep them in containers, if that's your only place to put them, that works great too. It's really good. You know, one of the other things I do is I often start peppers and eggplants when the days are nice and warm and the nights are nice and warm because they're so easy to start then. But tomatoes, you got to do it early because most of our tomato varieties simply aren't going to produce when those days get hot in June and late June and July. So count it down and you're going to see that you're going to have to start your tomato production as early as possible. And that, you know, ideally that would be early May. I think that's very hard to accomplish, frankly, on the Gulf Coast, even on the Gulf Coast, but you should try. You should try to get production started as early as early May. That's going to give you your best production. You can use a variety of tricks to do that. A wall of water is one of those tricks. We'll talk about that and why you should be thinking about things like a wall of water anyway. We'll be back here in a minute.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Yeah, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning, Alabama Sunday morning. Does it help if we have an open border, somebody said about the fire ants? You know, it's every disease, every insect is not brought in by people coming across the border in Mexico. By the time they've crossed Mexico, they've probably pretty well cleaned out any pests that they had with them. because it's a slow process. And that's not where it's happening. It's happening at the airports. It's happening in the shipyards. You want to pretend that it's about, that's not where it's happening. It's happening when people bring suitcases and the flight is very quick and the pest survives and the disease survives because they said, oh, I'm going to bring this fruit with me. I'm going to bring this thing with me. That's how it happens. That's how it happens. Now, I got to say, it would be wrong to say that it's because we have people crossing the border from long trips on foot. That's not where it's happening. And the evidence is there that that's not where it's happened. It's happened at the Port of Mobile for years and years. Usually happens with container goods, with shipments coming in. And that's why it's very important right now for us to have good inspection of containers and other things coming in at the border. It's not what happens on the Rio Grande. It's what happens at the Port of Mobile. It's what happens in Charleston and Savannah, New York, Los Angeles. These are the ports of entry where we're seeing the most impact on our gardens and on our lives, honestly, and on our forests. Let's see here. You know, it's killing the queen with the fire ants. It's great if you can do that. And you do tend to cause a brief slowdown in the colony. But if you've got a multiple queen colony, you can see how hard it is to kill the queen, right? Because you got multiple queens. And the colony survives. And the problem is that even if you manage to kill all the queens in a multi-queen colony, or even if you don't have a multi-queen colony, you're still going to get the fire ants coming in from your neighbor because they didn't treat, or from your neighbor's neighbor. And that will happen very quickly. And so it really comes down to, practically speaking, can you get the fire ants out of the places where you need to be active? And that's in your garden. The more active you are in your garden, by the way, the less chance you'll have fire ants. People used to talk about fire ant mounds being in their yards because they don't mow over winter. You start mowing and those fire ant mounds move. It's really funny. They don't just go underground. They just move because they can't stand the constant mowing. They have no tolerance for that. So constant disturbance is the key to managing fire ants, which is the best thing you can do. All right. Enough of the fire ant lecture. David is saying Satsuma is starting to bud out. I think this is all fine. It looks like about the right time, David, and I hope we're going to get lucky this year and we don't have these late things happening in March and April, which we've had repeatedly. All of 7 melatons have reemerged. That's really good. And David's going to get those tomatoes in as soon as he can. David has his own timeline. What, David, you shoot for about March 7th, I think, between March 7 and March 15. I think that works. I do think the earlier you can get them in, the better, but you really do want some protection for those tomatoes. I don't want to go off on that right now, but if you want to call me back in the next hour and let's talk about, you've got your tomatoes planted. Now what? Now what are you going to do? Now what are you going to do? What else? Other questions here. The idea of putting boiling water on fire ants. I guess we're going to be on this for a while, but it's okay. Boiling water is a huge disturbance to a fire ant mound. And it doesn't matter how many you kill, it's just going to be a huge disturbance for that mound. They are guaranteed to move. The problem with boiling water is you're going to burn yourself, and particularly if you do it at night. And if a hose will accomplish the same thing, do that. And the other problem with boiling water is if you got fire ants in your vegetable bed and you got vegetables there, you probably don't want to do that, right? So I have used the boiling water technique because, you know, years ago, until I realized, man, I'm going to kill myself. I'm going to burn myself here. It's a lot of pain. It's a big pain to do it. And I can use a hose to basically accomplish the same thing. That's my view on fire ants. That's it. Shovels and hose and a hose are going to be some of the most effective tools you have against fire ants. And there's no cure for fire ants. That's the other thing you need to know. Absolutely, I will stand by that. I will stand by that. My dad was certain he had gotten rid of all the fire ants on his property. And he did in a few places for several months. Cost him a lot. It was very expensive. And you know what happened? Before the year was out, the fire ants were back. And he didn't have enough money to do it again the second year and the third year and the fourth year. That's it. So it's managing. Don has a question about watering tomatoes. Good. Is it best to water at ground level at the base of the plant or 3 or 4 inches under the plant, which I have a couple of above ground planters designed that way? You know, for watering tomatoes in containers, I think in general the best way to do it is to have a tray or something underneath that will either catch the water moving through so that it can flow back up through the tray, or to put the container into some type of trough that allows the water to be absorbed from the bottom. One of the problems from watering from the top, and a lot of people successfully do it, but one of the problems is that the water doesn't tend to perk all the way down into the pot unless you water for 2 or 3 times. So here's the alternative. If you don't have a tray, if it's not possible to put your container down into a tray, and I've got some containers that are way too big to move around every time I water them. But here's the trick. In order to get that water down evenly throughout the pot, do what I can hear her say it. There was a very nice lady who was very fussy at me when I was in college, and I was trying to help her in the yard because I needed to make some money. And I would go around with a hose and just water everything. And she would, in trying not to be insulting, but not trying very hard, she said to me 3 times. She said it to me 3 times. She said the words to me 3 times. 3 times. When you water, water 3 times. Water everything in your container area. If you can wait just a little while, that's good. Come back around, water again, and then come around and water again. That has a really great and salubrious effect on your on how well water moves into those containers.
The fair is blue, the mountain.
It's Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast with Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Yeah, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. You know, if you're not asking me about tomatoes and what to do about them, it should be for 2 reasons. One, you know exactly what to do already, and you're outdoing it right now. Planting those tomatoes. This is the time to do it. This is the time to be going for it. If you've got your tomatoes, get them out as soon as possible. The weather is good for it. I worry about what could happen in late March because we can't see that far into the future. And we can get freezes and frost, as you know, into late March along the Gulf Coast, and certainly much later than that farther north. I don't recommend planting your tomatoes out farther north, by the way. I think I'd wait a while, wait a week or two, May 15th around Birmingham. March 15th around Birmingham, March 30th, or a little later around Huntsville. But on the Gulf Coast, it's time to do it. And you could still get a frost. It's not likely. It becomes less likely every day because our average last frost was somewhere around February 28th to March 1st in Mobile and Foley and Fairhope. But that's the last average. Sometimes they happen a little later, sometimes earlier, but that's generally the date we go by. And we just need a little bit of protection for that one in 20 chance, one in 100 chance that we'll have a freeze in late March or early April along the Gulf Coast. Lots of fun things to talk about besides tomatoes. We're talking about fire, and I'm going to come back to fire because we got some good questions and some good thoughts about it. Jerry is right. We need to think about the role of government in burning. And there are some ways that I do think that we need to change laws so that, or we need to have effective laws that protect the ability to manage southern ecosystems with fire, even as it protects the communities around them from the dangers of fires. And that's an interesting compromise, and something we have to think about. It's getting harder because our communities, we're not assembled in communities anymore. We just live wherever we feel like it. And that makes it really hard to manage for fire as well. And we're talking about fire ants as well. Not that they have anything to do with fire, really. They do respond to fire, unfortunately. But so do some of the native ants. And the native ants can often outcompete the fire ants in many forests. So that's an interesting thing. Fire ants, what are you going to do about them? And I will come back, and I'll say this over and over again, and I am firmly convinced of it, and you're not going to hear me say anything else. Disturbance is what moves fire ants. It doesn't matter how you disturb them. You can have all the most exotic disturbances in the world. You can use Dom Sérignon champagne. You can use club soda. You can use grits. You can use talcum powder. They all work in the same way. They send a signal to the ants that something weird's going on here and maybe we better move. People have caught on to us there. The talcum powder doesn't really kill the ants. May kill a few, but probably not many. What the talcum powder's doing is it smells like baby powder. And nobody wants to, you know, I don't know. I guess some people like the odor of it. But baby powder, just they don't want to, you know, it's foreign. They don't want to live there. They know something's weird, something's different, so they're going to move. Water can have the same effect. Water can have the same effect. And it's probably cheaper than baby powder. I haven't really priced baby powder lately, but I would suspect that water will do the same thing for you. A shovel, which you may already have, can just about do the same thing too. It's a disturbance. I'll say that over and over again. It's disturbance that helps you to control the location of where those fire ants are. You're not going to eliminate them otherwise. Somebody who worked in Savannah, and it's one of those text messages that I think was a voice text message, and so it's a little bit garbled. But I think the message is, yes, I used to work in Savannah, and yes, we were probably, the idea was, is that working in inspections, and the idea is that, yeah, what we're seeing is we're seeing these things come in suitcases and other things. And it's our ability to move from one place to another very fast that's making it, that means we have to control these things. Onboard ships was one problem. because you basically had a, you basically brought a whole ecosystem that these things could thrive in with bananas or whatever else. And so they could live on those until they got to the new port. But with, if you think about what happens with jets now and moving things from one place to another, it's like these insects, these diseases, there's almost no transition for them before they're on our continent and hopping off very quickly without much jet lag and moving into these new ecosystems. That's what happens. It happens over and over. We're not sure. It's how the kudzu bug got here, which is probably a good thing. Kudzu was introduced from several places deliberately. The kudzu bug came in by accident through the port of Atlanta, through the Atlanta airport. We're almost certain, and it spread from there. Had some impact on soybeans as well as on kudzu. So we need to be careful and thoughtful about those things as we do them. Let's see. Don wants to change the subject. Don, I'm always open to that, particularly when we have to talk too much about fire ants or borders or other things. Have you ever heard of or grown asparagus beans here in Mobile? Yes, I have. I actually had some at a high-end restaurant in Denver last year. They were quite good, so I'm growing some this year myself. Asparagus beans, yard-long beans, long beans, all a name for the same basic type of bean, which maybe you would want to call a pea because they're more closely related to black-eyed peas and to pink-eyed purple hulls. And to whippoorwill peas, field peas, cow peas, the peas that are the classic southern peas, basically these Asian long beans, long asparagus beans, are basically very closely related to the pea that has been one of the South's most famous crops over the years. Cow peas, field peas. So they do grow very well here. My dad loves them, grew them really well in the Black Belt. I had moderate success in Mobile. It may have been some disease issues, and I think it was in some years. So we may find that some varieties for Mobile itself may be better adapted because there are some disease issues. I also find that even though I thought they would be more heat tolerant, and I think they are generally, it's better to get them planted earlier. They seem to do better. They seem to do better when planted, at the same time you'd plant snap beans, which, you know, it wouldn't hurt to do it right now if you're on the Gulf Coast. Generally around the middle of March, I plant snap beans or beans in general. Pole beans. So I would try to get those in then. But yes, they should grow quite well. Organic matter helps all of them. They don't need a lot of fertilization at all. Maybe a little bit of potassium would be good. Fireplace ashes would be great. But don't over-fertilize them. They'll do fine. Amy, thank you for bringing us back to not fire ants, but fire. So Amy is asking, is it time to burn? And we're going to come back and talk about that. Amy, boy, it looks like you got a great setup there. I want to see that happen. But let's be cautious. Let's talk about it when we come back.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, welcome back. Let's see. Amy, that was what type of wildflowers? I'm coming to your question. So tell me what type of wildflowers you're planning on planting. Let me run through some of these questions I wanted to get to. So somebody got a Persian lime in a container and wanted to know how to take care of them. And, you know, I had a Persian lime in a container. I kept it for years until I had to go somewhere in summer and nobody was there to water it, and it just toasted. And, but, you know, it was really easy. And even during most winters along the Gulf Coast, they're really easy to manage in a container. As long as you put them on the south side of the house, and on the cold days, lay that container down on the ground, put some nice blankets over it. Usually that will help until temperatures get down to around below 15 degrees. Then you might have a little bit of a problem. But even then, I think that's a pretty safe way to handle it along the Gulf Coast. So really easy. Every now and then, you're going to have to fertilize. Let me just say this. I don't think you can use organic fertilizer. There's really no practical way to use organic fertilizer on containers like that. There are some benefits, and for things like potash, I think it's great. You can certainly use potassium. You could probably use blood meal more or less effectively. I don't think cottonseed meal is going to be as effective. So I would say go ahead and plan on your fertilizer regime just using a liquid fertilizer like Miracle-Gro, or use a granulated pelleted fertilizer that's a slow release. That's also fine too on those. And there's no special fertilization required. Generally, you want that middle number to be a little bit lower, because it does build up in containers over time. So if you get, like, I don't know, the numbers could be 12 to 8 or 12-0-8. That's probably not a good one for a container, but 12, the middle number should be the lowest number. The numbers on either end should be the higher numbers when you're using a fertilizer. And watering 3 times, which you may have already heard that lecture, 3 times when you water, water everything once, come back, water it again, and then come back and water it again. That makes all the difference. That makes all the difference. And then about every 2 to 3 years, you want to change the soil out. So what you need to do in about 2 years, you want to call me back and talk about, how am I going to change the soil out? How am I going to transplant this? And you also need to tell me what size pot you got it in. But we can talk more about that. What else? I know there was one other, and I'm gonna miss it. I have a pear tree, and the rootstock has become a problem. So what's happening, I'm imagining, is that there's a pear tree, and there's a bunch of stuff sprouting out below on the rootstock. So make sure it's below the graft. If it's coming from below the graft, well, it doesn't matter. If it's in the first 12 inches, you can cut it off. But here's the way I would do it, because I can't tell you, I don't know how big your trunk is. I don't know how much this has been an effect. It sounds like it's pretty serious. Cut it off about a quarter way. It's going to resprout. Cut that off when that happens. And then next year, you can cut it back a little deeper, about halfway down on the remaining stub, and cut all that off if it resprouts. The reason I say that is because if you've got a lot of sprouts and they're coming out and you want to get rid of them, you're going to leave a lot of holes in that trunk. And that's probably not a good thing. And it could stress the tree, and you could end up with some problems if you've got a lot going on there. So let's cut it back by about a quarter of its length right now. They're definitely going to resprout. There's no question. Cut those off when you see those happen. Then next year, cut that back, cut that stub back by half, cut all those stubs back by half. You'll be in good shape, and cut off the regrowth again. And then the next year, the third year, you can cut them all the way back to the base. You see what I'm saying? Let that tree grow first, and it'll tend to grow over some of those things, and they won't be as big an issue. And plus, you'll be casting shade, so they're not going to be as aggressive, and they'll be less of a problem anyway. Does that make sense? If it doesn't, you give me a call. We'll talk about it. We have, and Amy, don't you believe me? I am getting to your question, I promise. But we got a caller, and I want to get to that caller. Steve, who's our caller?
It is, I believe it's Debbie.
Debbie.
Yeah.
Debbie, I'm listening. What's up?
Yes, I had a question about I'm starting a garden this year. I usually do one in a little, you know, raised box, which I've had a little success with. But now I'm doing, you know, the garden in the ground. And I want to know about companion planting. I've been reading about it. Like, you know, a companion to a tomato plant. You would plant, like, basil or lettuce. And I read there's a lot of success with that. And going organic.
Okay. Let me take the easy one first.
Okay.
It's rare that there's any evidence that companion planting advantages your plants.
Oh, no.
Yes. So, you can say anything you want to on the internet, and people do say anything they want to on the internet, and people have talked about companion planting for a long time. There are certainly some types of companion planting that are beneficial. If you grow beans with your corn, oftentimes the beans may shed enough excess nitrogen, because they produce that it benefits the corn. And the corn stalk provides some structure for the beans to climb on. So that's a companion planting that works. Basil and tomatoes, I've been growing basil and tomatoes together for many years. And the reason I do that is because they grow at the same time. They need similar conditions. They need about the same amount of water. And I use them at the same time. And it just so happens they get planted together. I often plant my basil in a separate place from the tomatoes, and I can see no difference in pest pressure on the tomatoes. And that makes sense, because most of the pests that you would have on your tomatoes would be totally out of earshot of nose range of the basil. So
okay.
It I have experimented with this in many ways. I have never found that it is really, really useful. And I think there's so many other important things to think about when you're planting than companion planting. And I'll just be frank about that and blunt about that. You've got a lot of worries. The last worry, when you've solved all the other problems, then worry about the companion planting and prove me wrong. But just, I'm saying, don't worry too much about the companion planting first.
Okay.
It makes life easier, actually, doesn't it?
Yes. Well, it's my first real garden, so, you know, like I said, I've just been reading a lot about the companion planting and the organics. I didn't have luck with my tomatoes last year. The squirrels ate them, no matter what I did. The squirrels ate them.
Right, and you can see how companion planting isn't going to change that. So
right.
What are we going to do about the squirrels? Well, organic gardening is
shoot them.
Yeah, and feel free to try. So here's I will tell you this little thing about squirrels. Most, I would say that 75% of gardeners never have a problem with squirrels. 25% of gardeners have a problem with squirrels wherever they go, no matter where they plant. Why is that? Most of the time, and let me make up some numbers again, I'm going to say that 75% of those 25% of gardeners who have problems with squirrels, 75% of the time, it's because the squirrels are being fed artificially. And they can be fed artificially in several ways. Sometimes it's cat food left outside, but mostly it's bird food. So
yes,
if you are
feed the birds.
Yes, and there you go. And as long as you feed the birds, who have plenty of other food in life, by the way, other than what you feed them, but as long as you feed the birds and the squirrels are there gathering it, you're going to create an artificially high squirrel population, and they're going to do bizarre things. like eat tomatoes. So what am I going to do to help you? I do think chicken wire may help. I'm not sure it will, but you may try chicken wire. So it looks like John Prine is not going to let me finish this conversation. But let's listen to him for a second, and then we'll be back, and we're going to talk about, Debbie, we're going to talk about how to deal with squirrels.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
A lot of ground to cover. Tomatoes, it's time to plant. It's time to get them in the ground. Just a reminder. It's also time to burn. We're going to talk a little bit about that. And we've got some callers. Don, let me quickly say, I don't think, Don asked me about the cold snap last year and its effect on the hickories. I think that if you have a problem with your hickory, Don, I don't think it will be the result of the cold snap. I think it will be the result of the drought last year, which can be a big problem for hickories, particularly if they've had any root damage, and if it's been alternating between flooding and that's where you're going to see the problems for hickories is in the roots, not in the branches. Just my thoughts. So I do think the drought can have an impact on those hickories. They're pretty drought tolerant, but there's a big if. And we'll call me back next week. We'll talk about that in detail. Debbie, let's come back. Let's talk about the squirrels real quick. Because there's no end of trying to figure out what to do if the squirrels in your yard are going berserk. But are you still there? Debbie? Steve, did we lose Debbie? Did the squirrels get to Debbie too?
No, she's still there, Debbie. Hello? Maybe we did lose her.
Yeah, she's been gnawed to death by squirrels. I'll tell you, it's a big problem, and they're a nuisance. And if your neighbors are feeding the birds, that can also be a problem. So it's kind of squirrels, you know, a few squirrels, not a problem. When we artificially inflate the population by supplemental feeding of squirrels, and we do it accidentally or on purpose, you're going to start having a big problem. And almost everybody who has a problem with squirrels feeds the birds. I will say that the birds probably don't need the feed. In fact, I'll feel pretty confident in saying they don't need the feed. And let's don't get into that today. You call me next week when we have time so you can berate me about what I'm going to say. So let's don't say that. But just let me say the squirrels are a problem. What are you going to do? You may be able to use chicken wire around those cages. So that just makes it a little harder for the squirrels to get there. The trouble is, of course, you have to remove the chicken wire to get to the tomatoes. They will go under the cover. Here's another trick. It may work. It may not work. Squirrels, if you can, well, that's probably not going to work either. I think the squirrels are just going to be a big hassle. There is one thing that does work really well, and that is to have a feist dog. I used to didn't have to explain what a feist dog is, but it's a small dog that's very yappy that's going to go and just pursue those squirrels incessantly. And that may help. It may help with the tomatoes. Yeah, squirrels can be a problem. Let's see here. Some of our indigenous trees will come from last year. I'm worried I may lose my hickory. We got all that. Lots of fun things. Amy, let's talk about fire because Sean just sent me a picture of fire, on the ground. He's getting into the swing of things here late in the show. A beautiful burn looks like he's got going at his place, Sean Sullivan. He's really got it good. There's a Grady Pond. I don't think I would wait later on burning the Grady Pond. Oh, gosh, what a treasure. What a treasure. Amy, we're going to have to talk about what you're going to use for seeds. But let me say this about fire on your property. I'm looking at your property. I'm listening to what you want to do. The later you can delay the burn, the better off you're going to be. We want to make sure that there's no Bermuda grass and no Kogan grass. If you do see those, you want to spot treat them. But wait a little bit later. If you burn now, I don't see any big advantage. Let's wait just a little bit later. Let's wait until April and to do the burning, and maybe even into late April we'll think about it again. I think you're too early now. Given what I'm looking at, you're too early. And particularly for the Grady Pond. And they probably, Grady Ponds, it's an interesting thing. You want the water levels to be down just a little bit in the Grady Pond, not too much, but just a little bit. And so I think particularly the later you can burn that Grady Pond, the better. And you want to get rid of woodies, but you don't have any woodies there right now. But let's look at late April for that. Seeds. So swamp sunflowers, very interesting. There are two types of wetlands, and I'm going to be really gross in the sense of way too broad, and say there are two types of wetlands in Alabama. One is a rich soil wetland or a brown soil wetland, which is more associated with rivers. And then there's a black soil wetland, organic soil wetland that's associated with blackwater streams or Grady ponds or pitcher plant bogs. And they're very different. And the plants that grow there are different. I don't see swamp sunflowers. I more often see, depending on the variety, I more often see in those rich soil wetlands. But there are lots of plants that swamp hibiscus. I'm sorry, the hibiscus tend to grow more in the rich soil areas. There are hibiscus, though, that do grow in those pine land areas and along the Grady Ponds. And we'll talk about those, and we'll talk about how to go looking for them this summer. And you're going to call me back this summer, and we're going to talk about how to go look for seeds, particularly late in summer when those seeds are available. Right now, I don't think you need to do a lot of sowing. I think you need to just look at what you got, because you don't have a lot to sow, and just burn as late as possible. You're getting that in good shape. You're getting rid of the problem weeds like Bermuda grass. I never say it right. Bermuda grass and the Kogan grass. You really want to deal with those. Bahia, another problem. So when you burn, you're going to come back and we want to spot treat for those problems. And then you're going to be in great shape this fall to take those seeds and sow them out there. And you'll be hitting it just about right. I think you'll have space in between your native grasses for those seeds to take hold in the mineral soil. You'll be great. So I think this fall is probably when you want to plant, and you want to wait later. Yeah, you should burn the Grady Pond. You did hear me on that. And just wait a little while. Little bit too wet right now. Let's let it come in on the edges just a little bit more. Good. So companion planting of tomatoes and French marigolds for root knot nematodes. Probably it won't make a lot of difference. That's the honest to goodness truth. What we do find is that keeping the area clean with the marigolds works. You can suppress the nematodes, but if you have anything else in there, Bruce, that the nematodes can feed on, they're going to feed on that. Boom. Because remember, they're inside the plant. They get inside the plant. So No, it probably doesn't work very well, even though people have said it doesn't. Doesn't. Amy, I'm so glad I made you happy by letting you delay. So what else? We got some callers. Don, I'm going to come back here in just a minute. Pre-emergent weeds and how to kill them with glyphosate or here vinegar and Epsom. Ooh, that's a big one. Don, hold on to that one. Let's talk about it next week. I think you're a little late for pre-emergent on most things, but let's talk about that one next week. Who's our next caller there, Steve?
We got Bill in Mobile. He wants to talk
Bill,
to
I'm listening. World. Yeah, I'm listening, Bill. What's up?
Hello, Bill. I've talked to you in the past about bacterial wilt, and
you know, sir.
After a couple of years of my tomatoes and eggplants dying before the heat of June kills them, I found out that that's what I have is bacterial wilt in my soil.
Right.
So I replanted tomatoes last year, end of July, August, but I used 10-gallon grow bags, and I made a mix of pine bark and compost and loaded it in with that, and then I ran my drip tape down the line, and I planted my tomatoes, and I already had my posts in line for this Florida weave I used to stake them up, and I got tomatoes all the way through November.
That's right.
And what I'm liking about it is I'm not weeding, and below it I've got a lot. I plant a lot of leaves right on top of that soil and put the grow bags on top of that. And same thing with the eggplants. I planted those in the bags, and I got great eggplants last year. So that's how I'm starting out the year now.
That's great, and it works. It can get expensive after a while, and I think there are some other advantages. Here's what I will say. I always, to get rid of bacterial wilt, and it works great for me, I do try to find an area where I haven't grown tomatoes within the past couple of years. That's probably generally a good idea. But even if I replant in the same place, in the fall, and you can try this, just try it. If you haven't tried it, build up a pile of leaves about 4 to 5 feet high. Just dump the leaves there in the bed where you want those tomatoes to grow. You got a bed 4 feet wide, and just break the soil up if you like. Start loading those leaves on top of it in fall. When they are in spring, because you're going to get tons of live oak leaves, just make your start in spring and let those leaves molder down until they're about 6 inches high. You might want to add a little bit of ashes to it. Plant your tomatoes right in that, and you probably won't have bacterial wilt.
Bye.
So the music is, once again, not letting me quite finish the conversation. I don't blame that on Steve. Right, Steve? We're going to be back. We're going to be back.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Okay. Let's try to get to this. Bill, is Bill still there, Steve?
Bill, are you still there? Bill?
Well... yes.
The squirrels go, Bill.
So I know. Hey, Bill, so listen, folks, let me tell you, bacterial wilt is a big issue, along with other soil-borne diseases. Creating that fresh layer of soil with what you've got on hand is a really important thing. We don't have to support Lowdown Depot every time we want to plant a tomato. We don't have to throw away our money at Lowdown Depot. Grow bags are great if that's what you got and that's where you are. They will work. But rather than do that, use the grow bags for a year and get your garden ready, because once you get your garden ready to support your gardening effort, you won't need to use grow bags. I just got to say you won't need to use grow bags. But you got to get that topsoil ready. And there's a lot of benefits, I would say, to doing this with soil that you build yourself in your own yard. And we can get into that. You call me next week. You know, the leaves on the leaves on the live oaks are about to fall there, and there are probably some residual leaves on the water oaks and laurel oaks that are going to be coming down. It's the time to collect leaves. March is a great time to collect leaves on the Gulf Coast. And then farther north, you know, where you don't have as many live oaks, you'll be collecting in fall, but either way it works. You can start next year's tomato beds right now, coming up. We'll talk about that next week. I guess that's what I'm going to promise, to talk about that next week. What else we got? Let's see. Did I answer your question, your last question?
No.
A lot of people, let's see, Don with glycine. No, I told Don I was going to have to talk about that next week. It's too tough. We'll talk about that next week with glyphosate. If you've got weeds coming up now, and more than likely you do, and those are the ones you want to deal with, you don't want to use a pre-emergent now. I don't know what your summer weeds are. And for most pre-emergents, you're not going to be able to grow any seeds there. You're not going to be able to use any seeds there. I just don't think we got a lot of reason for a pre-emergent. And so I've got to know a little bit more, Don. You may have to call me next week. Let's talk more specifically about what kind of weed you're going after, because that's going to be really technical. And pre-emergents only work on certain types of weeds under certain types of circumstances. And for most people, there's really not a good or simple way of using them. So there it is. What else we got?
If you want to take the call.
Yeah, we got, I'm listening. Who's calling now?
Randy, go ahead.
Randy.
Yes.
Tell me what.
I've got a question on tomatoes.
Yes, sir.
I was at my store and I bought some plants. And the lady asked me if I knew how to plant them, and I told her I picked the lower leaves off to leave a tuft at the top, and I dig sort of a trench, maybe 5-6 inches, and I lay the plant down and fill it up and leave just the tuft above the ground. And she said that's the way she does it, but she doesn't pull the lower leaves off. She lets them die. I think she said it might create stress on the tomato. I was just curious if that's the way I plant them, do I continue to pick those lower leaves off?
Well, let me tell you, I don't plant my tomatoes that way. And there's a good reason why I don't. The biggest issue that you're going to have on the Gulf Coast is planting tomatoes too deep. Because of the excess moisture, particularly in spring, and the ground is colder, the deeper in the soil you go, and you want your ground to be reasonably warm when you're planting. And the one thing you need to know is that the roots that are too deep, particularly in our soils where moisture levels are high and where oxygen levels tend to be low, the roots that are too deep just simply die. So if you get replacements farther up the stem, you're not helping. So here's what I would say. This is, I'll tell you the way I do it, and it's very successful, and it really is a thoughtful way of dealing with the fact that our soils are a bit different and that our conditions are a bit different. I just simply plant up to the top of the root ball. And then as summer, and that keeps the plant pretty high in the ground, and then as summer goes on, I keep mulching and let... And then I mulch around it, just like I'm healing up a corn stalk. And you'll get some additional rooting growth up there without suppressing the root growth down below. In general, I don't feel there's any advantage to laying a plant down like that or putting it or burying it below the first leaves, unless you've got a very wispy plant. And then it's okay to do that. And then there may be some benefits, but otherwise I don't think it matters. Does it matter whether you cut the leaves off or leave them on? I don't think it matters. Because I don't think.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think planting too deep. I think the problem is just plant it at the normal soil level, unless the plant is too wispy. If it's wispy, and it shouldn't be, if you got it from Lowdown Depot or someplace like that, it shouldn't be a wispy plant. Because they've been growing them out in greenhouses. I don't think it'll matter. Did I say the wrong thing?
Okay.
It's funny because people have for years observed that tomatoes will put out roots along the stem if you bury them too deep. But the trouble is they didn't see what was going on down below, and that is that they lost all the roots down below. So basically, I would say, and this is true for almost every plant you plant at the soil level or higher and then build up around it. But I think particularly for tomatoes, I just don't see a lot of benefit in laying them down or otherwise, unless the plant is wispy. If it's got a real thin stem and it needs support, maybe plant it a little deeper, but not too much deeper, because the roots won't survive as well.
Okay, so laying it horizontal, shallower, is the same. Would it be the same as planting it shallower and then mounting, building up, hilling around the base of it?
If you planted it straight down in the ground, deep, that's the biggest problem. Planting it horizontally probably is not as big a problem. I just don't think there are any advantages to it.
Okay. That takes care of my question.
I'm sorry. And it's, you know, I was told the same thing when I was growing up, you know, plant it deep. But we've got a lot more information now about how plants function. And even though the plant may survive, it doesn't improve its performance. So it's because roots need to be near the surface where they can get oxygen.
Okay. Thank you much.
Thank you. Wow. Man, that's it, Steve. I can't believe you cut me off. After just 2 hours.
Yeah, just 2 hours.
Folks, we're going to be back next week.
Through the Arkansas mud, if I hadn't been a-ruttin' that Tennessee stuff.